Today's Teisho will be on case 16 in the Mumon Khan. Case 16 is entitled, When the Bell Sounds. Mumon said, the world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell? Mumon's comment, in studying Zen, you should not be swayed by sounds and forms. Even though you attain insight when hearing a voice or seeing a form, this is simply the ordinary way of things. Don't you know that the real Zen student commands sounds, controls forms, is clear-sighted at every event, free on every occasion? Granted you are free, just tell me, does the sound come to the ear or does the ear go to the sound? If both sound and silence die away, at such a juncture, how could you talk of Zen? While listening with your ear, you cannot tell. When hearing with your eye, you are truly intimate. Mumon's verse, with realization, things make one family. Without realization, things are separated in a thousand ways. Without realization, things make one family. With realization, things are separated in a thousand ways. So I want to thank everybody for doing an excellent job this morning, really sitting deeply in the Zendo. This is a collection of koans called the Mumon Khan, the checkpoint of no barrier. You could translate it that way. The Mumon Khan is full of stories, many of which involve a student and a teacher, and this teacher saying something to the student, and the student having an awakening experience. So, this is the classic way Zen students think about Zen. You're in confusion, and then something happens, and there's a dramatic opening, and then you see reality in a different way. And the Mumon Khan encourages us to think this way. There's something positive about that, right? I mean, it's definitely the case that if you don't come to Sesshin, you're not going to have a breakthrough. So, very rarely, never, do you hear of somebody saying, I stayed up last night and I watched a football game. And then I got up and I was making my scrambled eggs and I had a great awakening experience. It just kind of blew. That's definitely not going to happen. Somebody told me the Chinese have a saying that goes, you can sit on the mountaintop a long time before a roast duck flies in your mouth. In other words, it's never going to happen, right? So it's definitely the case that we need to come to Sesshin. If you practice regularly, if you practice daily, or you practice often, that's really precious. That's so wonderful. Having that relationship to your true nature, your big mind, is really magical. You get up in the morning, maybe this is you, maybe you get up in the morning, and I don't know, maybe you have an altar and maybe you don't, but you might light incense and light a candle and sit down, and even though you have a busy day ahead of you, you make time to be with your big mind. And you sit maybe half an hour, maybe an hour, maybe more. And then you go off to the demanding hours of your day. And that's a beautiful way to live, in my opinion, right? There's a kind of There's a kind of priority there, right? First I'm going to take care of my big self, my true nature. And you get up and you sit, and then you, having done that, you know, you can go off to work and you can deal with what the Chinese Buddhism calls the 10,000 things, right? This is the red dust of the world. And, you know, you get to work and there's this problem, you get to your student, you get to class and there's this problem, you didn't understand the lecture, you don't do well on the test. You know, that's a beautiful life, in my opinion. But if you don't come to Sesshin, something is really missing in your practice. You know, today we are going to sit 8 or 9 hours, meditating 8 or 9 hours. And that's practice of a different order, right, than just daily practice, which is itself quite wonderful. But, you know, in this process, you're really making a serious effort, right? And all of you will have or have koans that you're working on right now. And, you know, koans are stories that involve a student and a teacher. And, you know, at the end of the koan, usually the teacher, the student has some kind of breakthrough. And so, you know, in our practice, people are hoping to have some kind of breakthrough. And that's extremely valuable, it seems to me. You know, if you don't try, nothing will happen, right? So you know, there's something strenuous about Zen practice, and there's something strenuous about koan training, right? You know, the great danger is that people will practice meditation to quiet their mind and achieve stillness. And this is a great danger because that is not enlightenment, right? I mean, at first, you know, it's definitely the case that at least if your experience was anything like mine, you know, I was pretty unhappy 40 years ago when I was a young man. And I was probably a little bit depressed. And somebody told me about a Tibetan center near where I lived in Seattle. And I went to the Tibetan center, but there was no resident teacher there. You could go in and you could sit at your own pace. And there was one of those beautiful, very ornate Tibetan altars. And the cushions were burgundy and yellow, very colorful. And it just made me feel good just to go in there. And I had read a couple books on meditation, so I would just go in and try what it said in the book and feel better. But one day, somebody mentioned to me that a Japanese teacher had come to Seattle, Genki Roshi. And I went to sit with him, and it was hard, you know. He had people sitting for 30 minutes, and for me, getting through 30 minutes was really difficult. And then, you know, when I started doing koan training, also difficult, right, strenuous. You know, so I can remember as a beginner, just getting through half an hour being covered with sweat. And then, you know, I can remember working with my koans and being so frustrated. And one of the things that frustrated me about koans was that I myself was aiming for that feeling of peace and serenity that I got in the initial stages of my practice. In fact, even before I met Genki Roshi, when I would just go to the Tibetan center and sit, I was able to enter this state of peace and tranquility. You know, if you watch the breath and you follow the breath out and you follow the breath out and you follow the breath out, in not too long a time, you will be able to get into a kind of serene state. You know, your thoughts begin to recede and you feel good. It's just like a good feeling. This is samadhi, right? And that serenity, that stillness is like liberation for people like myself 40 years ago. I had a kind of obsessive personality. So, you know, I would take something that happened to me and I would turn it over in my mind again and again. And each time I examined the event or recalled the thing that bothered me, it would bother me all over again. And then I would do it again, and it would bother me all over again. And so, you know, being able to go to the Tibetan center and sit down and watch my breath was like a miracle, because I could get so still and so peaceful. And I loved that experience. And when I started doing Zen, I suddenly found myself in a very different place of having like to strain or to push. And it took me a long time to see the value of that. But one of the things that happened to me when I was in my early practice was that my world got sort of, you could say, split in two. You know, when I would sit down on the cushion, and if I ignored my koan and I just focused on my breath, I could get into that serene state. And for a long time, I was not making much progress with my Zen practice, because that's what I was doing. Without consciously deciding I'm going to go for the serenity, I went for the serenity. And so, you know, when I would go in to meet my teacher in Dokusan, I didn't have an answer to my koan, because I was spending my days in like kind of a serenity. That broke my world in two, because, you know, basically my world looked like this. When I was on the cushion, I was in a serene place. And when I was off the cushion, I was a nervous wreck, right? And those two worlds were like quite far apart. So, you know, when I was a graduate student in English, and when I would go to my English classes, I would be so stressed. You know, because I was in a pretty good graduate program. And I was competing with people who were really very smart and really well educated. Most of the people I was in graduate school with had gone to like Ivy League prep schools, you know, that kind of thing. They spoke languages, you know, that I didn't speak, you know. I often felt overmatched when I went into my graduate classes, because everybody seemed so capable. And I was very anxious a lot of the time, and I was anxious about my teaching. You know, I didn't think I was a good teacher. I burned through a lot of energy being anxious and fearful. And when I got to the cushion, however, I could be calm and feel much better. But those were like two separate worlds. And for a long time, the more fearful and anxious I felt in my professional life, my graduate student life, the more I desperately wanted to stay on the cushion and be serene. That's really like totally understandable, right? I mean, my world was tumultuous and very draining. You know, actually being stressed all the time or being unhappy all the time is very tiring, believe it or not. Because you're pushing all kinds of things in directions they don't want to go, and that wears you out. And then when I would get on the cushion, I would feel so much better. That serenity was really nice. But they didn't match, right? So, you know, Zen practice was complicated, because, you know, my teacher pretty early on gave me a koan. And he said, I want you to tell me where the breath goes, where the breath takes you, right? When I would watch the breath, I would enter deep samadhi, and I would feel calm and serene. And I had no idea where the breath was taking me. And in fact, I guess I didn't really want to ask that question. Because, you know, as soon as I asked that question, my serenity went away. And this is like a trap, I think, that a lot of Zen people fall into. In fact, a lot of people in Buddhism fall into. You know, Zen practice requires the ability to stabilize the mind. So it is crucial to be able to enter deep samadhi. You know, so step one of Zen training is learning how to focus on the breath, and you just gradually enter this serene state, which is really very beautiful, right? It's like this serene, imperturbable state. But if you remain there, you'd go no farther in your development, right? You remain in a divided world. And, you know, before I started sitting at the Seattle Zen Center, I used to sit in my apartment in Seattle. And at first I was meditating after in the late afternoon. I'd have gone to my graduate classes. I would have taught my own classes. And then I would be at home, and in the late afternoon I would do some meditation. But the more I got into this, the more I decided that it was important for me to get up in the morning and meditate. I would start getting up fairly early in the morning, but I was in this apartment, and above my apartment were two Iranian guys who would turn on the TV at 5 in the morning. I guess they just, as soon as they were up, they'd turn on the TV. And I would be trying to meditate, and I'd hear, you know, the weather report or something. And it would make me furious, you know. In my mind, I wanted to kill them, basically, you know. I mean, I wouldn't have killed them, probably. But I wanted to kill them, you know, because they were taking away my serenity. You know, my precious serenity. And so, you know, that's really why you can't trust your precious serenity, because it cuts your world in two. And if you practice just to be in that state, and it's so understandable that people would do that, right? Because life can be so challenging, right? Just to get in, to get the buzz on, right? If you do that, it's not much different, really, from getting stoned, right? It's not much different. It has many drug-like qualities, right? Because it's actually not taking barriers down, it's building barriers up. It's absolutely essential for people to be able to stabilize the mind. But if you just cling to mental stability or mental quiet, you can't overcome the obstacles that make your life unpleasant or threatening or nerve-wracking and so on. So, you know, so Zen is about entering samadhi and then learning how to tolerate a condition of uncertainty. Or not knowing, right? Not knowing. And that doesn't seem so inviting, right? And not only that, but your legs hurt, and you know, by around the end of day two, your legs are going to be hurting. You're going to be tired, and you know, you're not going to know what you're supposed to do if you're working on a koan. It's okay under those circumstances to just say, I'm going to put my koan aside, and I'm just going to be in that, I'm going to try to get back to that serenity. It's okay to do that, right? So, you know, it's, you know, today, later today or tomorrow, if your legs hurt a lot, all you have to do is survive, right? So just keep focusing on the breath, and you'll find at the end of your breath there's this imperturbable calm. And just go there and stay there, you know, and stay there and let it take care of you. But you know, at some point in the session, you have to move off of that place of serenity and be a little bit uncertain. And you have to try, right? I mean, you have to try to answer the koan, right? But you can't answer the koan. So you have to try, but you can't answer the koan. And that's very much like life, isn't it? You know, that's very much like life. You know, we have an expression, you can't win. You just can't win. Well, actually, it's definitely the case that in life you just can't win. You know? And people who think they're going to win are kidding themselves, right? I heard this Tibetan teacher who said something that I read to a friend of mine, and he got so upset that I said, well, let's just forget about it. But the Tibetan teacher said, we start out our lives like a sailing ship, right, that's leaving the harbor with new sails, you know, all the rigging is brand new, the ropes are new, they're neatly coiled on the belaying pins or whatever you coil rope on. And you set out. And he said, your ship is going out into the great ocean. And he said, you know, at the end, the ship is, there's going to be holes in the sails, and the rope is all frayed, and the boat is going to sink. Right? You know, my friend got very upset. He said, that is a very pessimistic view. It's like, but that does happen. You know, that has happened to, you know, billions of people. I was just reading the other day about this novelist who, here's a better example. You know, Gauguin, I mean, Van Gogh didn't sell a single painting in his entire life, right? And these are some of the greatest paintings anybody ever painted. But, you know, he didn't know he was going to be Van Gogh. He didn't live to see that recognition, right? So you know, being alive involves a certain amount of failure and confusion and frustration, right? And if we avoid those things, we can't wake up. But if we learn how to stabilize our minds, and then sort of we go to that place where we're, you have to answer, but you can't answer. See, you have to answer, but you can't answer. That's life. You have to do it, but you can't do it. Right? That's life. And it's, that's the truth, right? It's the truth, right? I mean, we all feel, you know, we all want to be, I'm sure Van Gogh, the world Van Gogh lived in, you know, he wanted to paint these paintings. He wanted to, and he spent, Van Gogh studied paintings day and night. You know, they found his notebooks and they said he was far from untutored painter. He wasn't an amateur. He had studied all the great art of the West, and also he was fascinated by Asian art. And he was trying to fuse Asian art and Western art. And he spent, you know, his whole life doing this. You know, he'd get up in the morning and think about painting, and he'd paint, and then he'd go to bed. And the next day, get up and think about painting. You know, so naturally what he had in mind was he'd paint these paintings, and somebody would go, mon Dieu! You know, these are brilliant. These are fantastic. You know, you're a genius, right? Because he was a genius. But people wouldn't even look at them, right? So you have to answer your koan, but you can't answer your koan. He had to paint, but nobody wanted his paintings, see? So this is life, right? And if we retreat from that situation, we can't wake up. We want to paint the painting and have somebody go, you are a genius, Vincent. Vincent, you are a genius. But that didn't happen to him. And it doesn't happen to most people in the world. And even the ones that it happens to have reasons to feel frustrated. So the experience of being serene and at peace is a wonderful experience, but very limited. And the art of Zen, and I think maybe the art of living, is not allowing yourself to stay there too long, but to, you know, go into that place that's frustrating, where you have to answer your koan, but you can't answer your koan. And you have to want to answer it, but you also have to be willing to be in a kind of frustrated state, or a stymied state. And you could say, well, what's so good about the stymied state, you know? But in that condition, in that place, which is where the koans, you know, when these koans describe a student and a teacher, the teacher's job is to put the student in a place where he feels blocked or he feels stymied, see? Because that's where openings happen. You know, what happens to people if they put themselves in that place and they sit for 5 days at Zazen is that they encounter a different way of being, right? A different, you could say, different way of living, different way of experiencing the world. You know, people go to on vacation, right? Sometimes, and you know, vacations are very refreshing. Because, you know, you're not on your vacation, you're not your normal self, right? You know, basically, I went out to Colorado, and I didn't have to go to my job, you know. Nobody knew me, you know. I didn't have a schedule. I didn't have any deadlines. I mean, I did wind up having a deadline because somebody called me and I had to edit this book on one of the days of my vacation. But for most of my vacation, I was just not Kurt anymore, right? I would say it was really a great experience, right? You know. I went on some hikes, and if somebody had said to me, "You're going to hike up to the top of this mountain. Why are you doing that? What are you getting out of that?" You know, I could say, "Well, it's beautiful," which is probably true, but that's not why I was doing it. And if somebody said, I could say, "Well, it's healthy. You know, I'm getting fresh air in my lungs." That would just be bullshit. You know, so why am I going? There's, you know, what's so beautiful about doing something like that is that there's no reason to do it, right? I'm not getting paid. You know, I'm not getting recorded in a book somewhere where somebody say, "And among the many people who have gone up Mount so-and-so is Kurt Spellmeyer." I'm not going to be remembered for going up the mountain. It's a totally, in a certain way, it's a totally useless thing to do. And there are many people who would say, you know, "Why the hell are you doing this? It's totally useless." But, you know, actually, it's so beautiful to do something that's totally useless. It's like, it is, I think, liberation. Because, you know, the things we call useful are often not real. You know, I think my job is very important in a certain way. You know, so I teach English at Rutgers University, and I do my very best to be a good English teacher. But you know, actually, this is shocking, but someday Rutgers University will probably not exist. It's probably true. You know, universities come and go, right? Or at least Rutgers that I know isn't going to exist anymore. And, you know, somehow everything's going to be okay. You know, so we create something called Rutgers, right? Rutgers. And we create something called a professor, right? He's a very important professor. And, you know, if you are a professor, you should try to be a good professor. And if you work at Rutgers, you should try to make Rutgers a better place. But, you know, it's not real. It's not real. It's a game we play. And if we take it too seriously, you know, we become miserable. You know, so I have a friend who has, you know, if you might not know anything about universities, but, you know, in universities, you would think they're just like professors and students, but it's not like that. The professors are ranked, like the Army. You know, my father was in the Navy, he had a certain rank, and on our base where I grew up, all the kids had their father's rank, so... You know, if you were the admiral's son, you were a better kid than the captain's son, and so on. So you know, basically, a university works like that, too. You would think everybody would be happy just to teach, right, or just to learn. But there's all these ranks. So there's like instructor, assistant professor, associate professor, professor. And now they even have another one. It's called professor two. It's like professor, professor. Boy, that's a real professor, you see. People create these distinctions, which are imaginary, right? And we get boxed in. You know, so I have a friend of mine who is an associate professor. And he has never been able to write his second book. And he's been so miserable. You know, he comes into our department every day, I think, and he looks around and he goes, professor, 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 and then he thinks, and I'm an associate professor. You know, there's a guy in my department who's written like 8 books, you know. So every time my friend looks at this guy, he must feel like he wants to drop down into the ground because he hasn't written 8 books, you know. You know, basically, these distinctions which make us so unhappy are not real. And when we go on vacation, right, you know, we realize, you know, actually, Kurt is just a game I play. You know, every 2 weeks I get a check that says Kurt, and I definitely take it to the bank. But I'm really not Kurt. I'm really not. And, you know, I work at Rutgers, but, you know, that's not who I really am. It's not. And when you go on vacation, you suddenly realize this. You know, you meet people who are like retired, right? And the things that used to bother them, they just laugh about because they realize it's not that important. It was just a game I was playing, right? You know, when you are no longer a professor, when you are no longer Kurt, when you are no longer, you know, in that game, you realize, you know, that was a game, wasn't it? And suddenly, you know, I think the world is a vaster place, you know. In the Buddhist point of view, all of these things that humans do are important, but not real, right? And you know, you have to go, sometimes you could say you have to go through all this unhappiness to realize you didn't have to go through all this unhappiness. You know, that what you had to learn from all of this was that none of this was real. And when you realize it's not real and you realize you're not Kurt, you know, actually you realize, you know, this world is vast in all directions, right? Vast in all directions. You know, I have no name and no birthday and no death day. And I am everybody I meet. You know, and I am nothing fundamentally, and that state is like encountering your true nature. But we are so fear, and to some degree attachment, you know, make that state very difficult for people to enter. Even if our identities make us unhappy, we cling to them. And, you know, my friend who goes into Rutgers every day and feels terrible because he hasn't written 7 books, you know, he clings to that identity even though it makes him sick, you know. And it's not easy for, it would not be easy for him to get out of it. You can't just say, I realize now this is all a game. Right? It's difficult to get out of it. So, you know, what we're doing in Zen practice is gradually waking up from that game and seeing that we have this freedom. You know, fundamentally, you have no name. You know, fundamentally, you aren't living in the 21st century or any time at all. You know, it's like you're on vacation all the time, right? You just don't know it. And Zen is about learning how to be on vacation all the time. You know, our culture keeps trying to get us to play these roles that make us unhappy. And one way to get out of those roles is to, like, quit your job and, you know, jump on a train and ride the train to Alaska, but you're still in your roles, right? I mean, that doesn't really work very well. But there's another way to live, which is not to be so attached to our identities and to the games that we are expected to play, and to encounter this fundamental freedom, this we say emptiness at the heart of ourselves, you know. And so this koan, you know, is actually inviting us to do that. You know, Umon says, the world is vast and wide, right? Why do you put on your 7-piece robe at the sound of the bell? One way to understand that koan is, you know, you are like a being who has no birth and no death. You know, you have no identity. And yet you live, you know, you get up and you race to your job and you worry about this and you worry about that. And you compare yourself to other people and make yourself sick. And so on and so on. And it's easy to make fun of that, but we all do it, right? I mean, you know, if you work on, you know, if Van Gogh worked so hard on his paintings, you know, spent thousands of hours, and then to have somebody just say, this is junk, and nobody understood what he was doing, that's really hard to take. You know, it's like you're so, we say, invested in that. But what if we could do things without being so invested in them because we realize they have no purpose? You know, what if we, if that's like a vacation. Why did you walk up the mountain, right? Why did you walk up the mountain? You know, one day we hiked for 8 hours, and it was a steep, especially the first part was really steep. You know, and covered with sweat, you know, and came back down and wiped out, had dinner and fell asleep. You know, somebody say, why did you do that? You know, that was so much work. What did you get out of? Nothing. Nothing. But it was like, it's vacation. Don't you get it? It's vacation. This is like exercising our, rediscovering who we really are. You know, I didn't have to get to my office today at 9:30. I went up a mountain, you know. I didn't have to answer the phone. I didn't have to deal with so-and-so. I didn't have to write memos all day. You know, I could do anything I wanted, and I chose this purposeless act of going up a mountain. And I'll tell you, that was unforgettable. Everything was so alive, right? Because I wasn't Kurt, right? And I wasn't doing something that was, you know, necessary, right? So, you know, in a way, the koan is saying, you know, why do we live this way? You know, what this is like for monks, you know, you put on your 7-piece robe and you do this every day. And one way to do it is to do it, you know, in a bad spirit, as we would say. You go, oh boy, back to the old grind, you know. Man, you know, and you meet people all the time. It was at the beginning of the year, a couple of years ago, and I was in the parking lot, and I met this guy from the religion department that I know. And I said, hey, we're back at school, huh? And he said, oh, yeah. You know, it's like, I can't wait, you know, 2 more years and I'm out of here, right? You know? And it was like, it astonished me. I was not ready for that. You know, because I was thinking, okay, you know, this is going to be interesting this year, you know. And he was just, his attitude was like, you know, oh man, here we go again, you know, counting the depth, scratching the days off the calendar. You know, and I mean, he's right, he has a right to his way of thinking, but I mean, if you think about it, you know, actually, I've been a restaurant manager, moving man. I've moved furniture for the Mayflower Moving Company. I've been a carpenter. I've been a carpenter's assistant. I've been a line cook in an Italian restaurant. I've painted houses. And I'll tell you what, I have the best of all those jobs. I'll take the job I have now. I think it's the best job. You know, I get to talk to people about interesting ideas. You know, that's pretty good. So, you know, my friend, it's, you know, just, I think he just had the wrong attitude. He's too caught up in it, right? You know, maybe he didn't write enough books and he felt inferior or something. But, you know, so that's one way to look at this koan. But, you know, and Umon is talking to monks. You know, and monks, if you think about it, have a very routinized life, you know. I mean, you know, monks are monks, you know, 24/7, right? And every day, if you're a monk, pretty much every day is going to be the same as the next day, right? It's like, you know, pretty much up at 3:30, meditation, you have some work in the monastery, and then, you know, meditation, lights out, next day up at 3:30, right? So, you know, there must have been monks who think, oh, brother, you know, another day of meditation, right, you know. So Umon's saying, you know, why do you do this? You know, put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell. When the world is, you know, vast and wide, you could be free. Another way to look at the koan is, you know, actually, you know, when you're trapped, that's when you can really wake up, right? You know, when you're sitting on the cushion and your legs hurt, you know, you could just jump in your car and drive home, but that doesn't make you free, right? Being free means encountering that nameless, faceless, birthless, deathless person that you are, you know, when you're not calling yourself Kurt or Bob or Susan or whatever. You know, we discover that person every once in a while. It sort of peaks out or we bump into it. And it's like, wow, that it's so wonderful to realize I'm not Kurt, you know. And when I realize that, you know, the world is vast and wide. And so, you know, putting on your robes, you know, actually is a, you know, seven-piece robe. That's a lot to put on, right? You know, you have to be careful. You know, actually, if you know anything about monk's robes in classical China, you know, there's a way to put on your robe. The kesa has to be folded, has to be put on a certain way. You know, if you make a mistake, you know, people will judge you as incompetent. You're not a good monk if you can't put your kesa on right. You know, all of that's burdensome and a trap, you know. But on the other hand, you know, when we are trapped, we can shift into this other self, this bigger self. And it's very hard if we're not trapped in a way to do that. You know, so the koan actually sort of sets a trap for us, right? You know, it says you have to answer this koan, but we know you can't answer the koan. And you sit there and think, I want to answer that koan, but I have no idea how to do that. And that's frustrating, annoying, can be angering, can be disheartening. And when it gets to be too much, just calm down and watch your breath and go into samadhi and be at peace. But every once in a while, you have to try to answer the koan. And when you do, you may be frustrated. But in that process, somewhere along the line, you realize, you know, this world is vast and wide. Far vaster and far wider than I ever thought. You know, and I think that's why some people get hooked on Zen, right? Is that the vastness, as it says in the sutra we're going to recite this afternoon, the vastness that underlies us all, right? We actually kind of have to be trapped to get there, but when we get there, we realize, you know, I only suffered because I had to realize that I didn't have to suffer. Umon said, "The world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell?" Umon's comment, "In studying Zen, you should not be swayed by sounds and forms. Even though you attain insight when hearing a voice or seeing a form, this is simply the ordinary way of things. Don't you know that the real Zen student commands sounds, controls forms, is clear-sighted at every instant, and free on every occasion? Granted you are free, just tell me, does the sound come to the ear, or does the ear go to the sound?" Now, if you take that question seriously, you're trapped. "If both sound and silence die away at such a juncture, how could you talk of Zen? While listening with your ear, you cannot tell. When hearing with your eye, you are truly intimate. With realization, things make one family. Without realization, things are separated in a thousand ways." Got it. But then Mumon says the opposite. "Without realization, things make one family. With realization, things are separated in a thousand ways."